Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Great to have you, and very excited to have a guest on that I've been a fan of for a long time. An amazing writer, very funny, and someone who I would always stay up to watch on The Tonight Show when she appeared. The very, very funny author who has a great book out called 50 Things That Aren't My Fault, as well as historic comic strip Kathy. It's Kathy Geiswite. Nice to have you on the show. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much. A great big honor to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks. You know, it's funny, just sort of in a larger sense, what I always liked about your writing was it almost in a way was relatable to men too, because while you focused on women and the trials and tribulations of everyday life, I felt like you never were writing women as like heroes or superhuman, perfectly idealized people, but as struggling to get just through the day-to-day life. And in fact, you had this quote that says, "I wrote for the women who valiantly practiced the speech and then delivered it to the box of frozen Girl Scout cookies, not to the guy it was meant for." That's who I think needs and need in my work. I think that's terrific. And that's always what I got from you. If you had a voice like that when you were young, do you think you would have been a different person yourself? Because you obviously provided a lot to a lot of people through this point of view.
You mean if I were the one who could give the speech to the guy instead of the cookies?
Yeah.
Would I have done different work? Yeah. Well, yeah, I would have, but I don't think that, I think that the people who needed my comic strip and who need my book now, as I pick up at this point, life at this point in our grown up years, I think that, they need reassurance of those little moments, you know, then when we don't have things all together, when our intentions stray far, far, far from the reality. And I heard from a lot of men over the years who really loved my work, partly because they felt it gave some insight into the female experience, that men would write and say, "Well, you know, for the first time in my life, I understand why my girlfriend or wife has, you know, 14 pairs of what identical black shoes." And I realized that she's not actually insane. This is just something girls do.
Yeah. And you seem to say, I mean, you've said, you know, that you hope women will feel good about themselves by letting them know that they're not alone. I would imagine you sort of got a lot of feedback from people feeling that way, that they weren't alone and through your strip. And I assume through other writings that you've done.
That's the greatest response I've ever had to my work, is people writing to say, "Thank heaven somebody else understands me." I think the comic strip, a lot of times people even enjoyed it secretly, like they wouldn't necessarily like to admit that they had certain vulnerabilities. They would read my strip, you know, and tuck it away in a drawer or a scrapbook or somewhere and go and think, "Well, you know, somebody else knows what I'm going through now."
Yeah.
And I think that now in 50 Things That Aren't My Fault, I think a lot of women are going to, especially women, I don't mean to exclude your entire gender, but especially women. Although I have to say, I always sort of took pride in the fact that I wrote something that I didn't think men would ever really completely get, you know, that it was something of the time that was like for women. Mm-hmm. In a way other comic strips weren't. But I don't think my book is like that. I think that it's, my book isn't so woman focused, although because it talks about this great kind of generational transition that a lot of people my age are in, where, you know, suddenly we're trading places with our parents. You know, I'm trying to get my mother to bribe my mom to eat her broccoli, and my daughter's scolding me for my cluttered computer desktop. And
yeah, you call it the sandwich generation, right? That's what you are. You're the—
No, we're not the sandwich generation. I don't feel at all like a sandwich. This is the panini generation. We're squashed. I am squashed between everything that I think I need to do for my parents and then everything I need to do for my daughter on the other side. And I'm smashed in the middle with this horror, sudden horror, that I realize I'm running out of time to do everything that I wanted to do in my life. And we're also living at this time where, you know, declaring your own aspirations is very, you know, is the thing to do. So I declare my aspirations, but I've got mom on one phone and my daughter on the other phone and I can't do it.
Yeah. I totally relate. Mm.
Yeah.
It's not so much even gender specific. I mean, as a man, you know, I'm married, we have a son and my mom is 90. She's still running her furniture business. We're trying to get her stuff. Although your focus is women, I think the underlying emotionality and point of view of a lot of your stuff is very relatable to men as well. You know,
one of the essays in 50 Things That Aren't My Fault is called Helicopter Daughter, and it could certainly be Helicopter Son just as easily, because it's about literally chasing my 90-year-old parents around the house, trying to convince them that they're old enough to wear emergency alert call buttons, and trying to, you know, seeing, like, it's like watching a toddler watching my aging parents.
Right.
Because you see all the things that are dangerous for them.
Yeah.
And they don't listen. They're belligerent and stubborn.
Yeah. My mother, I've talking to my mother about two weeks ago. What are you doing? She says, well, I'm sitting down. She's like, well, I bumped my leg. What do you mean you bumped your leg? Well, I bumped it. And how long has it been? She goes, this is the third week. I go, Ma, you didn't bump your leg. You injured your leg. She apparently was moving a sofa herself and hit her leg. But what she doesn't do is she doesn't tell you, especially the kids. She gets friends to help her because she knows if she tells one of her three children that we're going to start to put parameters on her. And it's
exactly.
Like, well, we had another, I don't want to make this about me. I talked to my brother. He goes, you know, my father worked in the business too. We had a moving van to deliver the furniture. My father's been dead for 20 years. My brother calls me about 6 months ago. You know, daddy's van was stolen. I go, no. I go, when? He goes, a year and a half ago. And my mother told the guys that work for her, don't tell my kids that the van was stolen. They revert to like 17-year-old children. It's insane.
They did. When I went to visit my parents on a trip, I said, well, I'll drive, you know, of course I'll drive, not them. And there are no brakes in their car. And, you know, I couldn't get the car to stop. It's rolling out of the driveway. And Dad said, oh yeah, you have to pump the brakes. He said, the first time you get in the car, you have to like go back and forth in the driveway, pumping the brakes for about 10 minutes. And then you can go drive. This is 90-year-old parents. This is the car they were driving.
Oh, God.
And it was just, you know, yeah, they wouldn't have mentioned it.
Yeah. But. Yeah. You know, you talk about your daughter's generation and, I'm really fascinated by this. There's a quote of yours. You said, my generation thought that by the time our daughters grew up, pay would be equal, harassment would be non-existent, companies would have figured out how to embrace parenthood. You talk about you're living in a world where your generation thought you were fixing things for them, but apparently didn't quite fix it. What are some of those obstacles that your daughter has that you see now that maybe your generation didn't fix or couldn't have been expected to fix?
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that we, that one of the great liberations mm-hmm. that we gave our children, I talk about in the essay called the Build a Boob Workshop, where I'm taking my daughter into Victoria's Secret. And every mother of a teenager has experienced this horror. Where, you know, my generation, the mom carefully sewed little hooks in my shirt so my little white bra strap wouldn't show. And my daughter is flinging herself, you know, toward the magenta hot push-up, you know, power bra with the matching thong.
Right.
So what did we liberate them? We taught our daughters to feel good about themselves, that they were free to express themselves, you know, that they can own their own beauty and their own bodies. And yet, the world still judges bodies just as harshly. You just can't talk about it. And I think a lot of young women now dress in a much more liberated and empowered way, and yet possibly send, I keep telling my daughter, you're possibly sending mixed messages when you dress like that.
Right.
That's a big difference.
And how does she respond to that? I think that's a really valid point that you made to her. How does she, I'm just curious how that something like that responds to that comment.
There's only one response from a young woman, and that's defensive, pretty defensive. You know, it's funny too, because as much as my generation was hoping that we were teaching our daughters that, looks don't matter, appearance doesn't matter, it's the inside. And yet I'm so aware that my daughter's generation has to be camera ready at all times. You know, they communicate with photos of themselves. Mm. And, you know, I used to get, take flack from people when I said, I didn't really like to answer the phone if I didn't have mascara on, because I didn't feel like I was, myself. But my daughter now has to, the hair has to be done. They get up and get camera ready and then go about the day. It's very different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also, the other thing is that I don't think, relationships have changed dramatically. In an essay called Barbie Mom, I talk about, how I used to hate Barbie dolls and that whole thing. And now I love them, how I kind of long for the Ken doll,
right,
who is just this, innocent dude on the side of my girl's room versus what young men and women go through now when they're dating. It's incomprehensible to me that the human, heart and soul have kept up, has progressed as fast as the electronics have, that it's a lot of things happen in relationships that I don't think young people are ready for.
Yeah. And I think the social media aspect of it has a good amount to do with that. I mean, I don't know how I would have coped. And especially if you're a young girl, back, 30 years ago with social media. I mean, I how do you feel like, how would you have negotiated that world as a young Kathy if you had that in your world, in your life?
I can't imagine. I mean, when I was mostly dating, we didn't even have an answering machine. So,
Exactly.
And now, when I think about courtship now, and I spent... wasted, I'll say, the best years of my life. When I was young and pretty and open to relationships, I wasted those years lusting after somebody who was not available to me. Mm-hmm. Now, I glanced online at an online ad for a juicer one time, and I've been courted by the juicer company ever since. I get emails daily. Are you still thinking about me, the juicer? Is there anything the juicer company can do for me? The juicer company remembers my birthday. It sends me a Valentine. It pops up on every page I open, just on the side, like flashing. Remember me? It asks about my wants and my needs.
That's so funny. That's your guy. If only a real guy could do that, am I right? It's so funny you should say that, because a friend of mine bought a new BMW, really nice car, which I don't have. And I started looking at BMWs online last night. I'm not going to buy one. I don't know what I was thinking. But I started to think, oh man, I'm going to get bombarded with BMW ads for the next year. I'm afraid to even do something. Yeah, to act on my own impulses in my own house. How's your relationship with your daughter similar or different than the one you had with your parents?
My daughter and I are truly best buddies. Mm-hmm. So that's a beautiful thing. And I think I can talk to her a lot more openly than my mom and dad maybe could talk to me. So I think that that's a big difference. That's a nice thing.
Yeah.
Mind you, she hasn't read my book, so she hasn't. We're speaking to each other up until the moment when possibly she reads the book, and then we'll see.
I find this apparent. We're talking to Kathy Geiswhite. She has a new book out, 50 Things That Aren't My Fault. And of course, the great Kathy comic strip that she wrote for 34 years. There's a thing that I try to do, which is as a parent, called breaking the cycle. Like my mother, I don't remember my mother ever saying that I love you. Now, I know she does. I don't know if it's a generational thing or, my mother's a kind of a hard driven woman as it is, but. And my dad didn't even do much either. So I'm constantly saying to my son, I love you. I want to hang up the phone, all of that. Are there sort of cycles that you try to break as a parent with your daughter that you had with your parents that you don't want to continue with your child?
I'm never going to do this. I'm never going to have a kitchen filled with expired ingredients and then try to cook lunch for my daughter. I promised her. Mom will take eggs seriously, like from last Easter, right, and whip up an egg salad with mayonnaise, you know, from 1989. She's from the, you know, she's from the Depression era. Yeah. She's lived through a lot. She believes the expiration dates are a big scam. And guess what? Once you're past 90, you do believe that expiration dates are a big scam, you know, because you're kind of proven otherwise, right? So that I'm not gonna poison my daughter.
I gotta get your parents together with my mother, because it's the same thing. Like, I got a call from my sister. She goes, "I went to mommy's house." Yeah. You're not going to believe the crap that was, it was like mold. I just threw stuff out, and she started yelling at me that I was throwing stuff out. It's like half cut tomatoes that were cut like 2 weeks ago, and they're no longer red. They're green, but they didn't start green. Like, it's insane. It's just, it's, I mean, maybe we'll be there when at that age. I don't know. But, you know, I feel like you're really, you're an eternal optimist in your writing. You, about the book, you say this is a book about holding on to hope, dreams, and a sense of humor through the grown up years when everything starts changing and disappearing without our permission. What are those things that disappear and change without our permission, just out of curiosity, from your perspective?
Everything. First of all, the people are disappearing. You know, loved ones are leaving the earth way before we're ready. Great friends are moving away. People are retired. At my age, people retire and then, you know, they're gone. Our daughters are, our children are leaving home. Mm-hmm. Our parents are, you know, at the very least, going backwards and all the developmental milestones. But it isn't just the people. It's like the, I had 1 6-month period where every single appliance in my home broke. And the stores I depended on being here forever, you know, the cute neighborhood stores, they left. The person at the one store that I knew is gone. The brands, you know, it takes me longer to pick out a loaf of bread in the grocery store than it took my grandma to bake one from scratch, from, you know, from grain that she harvested in the field herself. And those, all of those little things, you know, you think, you know, so what?
Seriously,
how many things does my tube of toothpaste need to do? And how much of my beautiful life right now, when I'm squashed for time, how much of my life have I wasted in the toothpaste aisle trying to decide, you know, do I just want it to clean my teeth, or do I also want to protect the enamel, or do I want to, you know, do I want the extra, the whitening, or the, the extreme whitening?
Too many choices and too many decisions to make. I mean,
but I'm saying that all those choices add up, and they work on you. And by the end of the day, between the things that are disappearing, that are familiar, that are gone, and then all the choices you have to make where you suddenly feel like, I have no decision-making skills anymore, all those things like chip away at your self-confidence. And that's why, you know, at the end of the day, you are holding hands with a box of frozen donuts. I mean, there you go.
I feel the same way. It can get so complicated, and I just think that it doesn't need to be as complicated as it is. And I'm not quite sure why, if it's sort of just sort of life in general, or if there's some bigger force at work that's sort of trying to teach me a lesson. But I just I scratch my head a lot of times at this.
And you scratch your head alone, because part of the problem right now is it's so lonely, because I find like I'm increasingly isolated from people. I can no longer go to a dinner party because I'm 8,000 episodes behind on my television viewing, and I never have any idea what anybody's talking about anymore.
Right. If one more person says to me, Game of Thrones, and then expects me to know Game, I don't watch Game of Thrones. Okay. I'm coming out on my own show right now that I don't watch it. I haven't watched it. It just doesn't. And I feel, I don't know what the word is, nerd, out of it. I don't know what, but I can't tell you how many people make reference to that show, and I know nothing about it.
Listen, I still have to catch up on The Sopranos. I'm way behind the Game of Thrones. It's like not even on the top 400 list right now. So guilt, I mean, the guilt of all that, it's not guilt. I mean, there is a guilt multiplication that adds in, you know, you used to eat one thing like a muffin. You have calorie guilt. That's normal. We're used to that.
Right.
Now you have the calorie guilt, the carbohydrate guilt, the fat guilt, the sugar guilt, the non-organic blueberry guilt, the non-biodegradable wrapper guilt, the manufacturing process pollution guilt. I have the Netflix guilt. You know, when I have the podcast guilt, actually, sorry, but, you know, there's so many things now to listen to.
Yeah.
So I can no longer feel angry. Here's what's been robbed from me. I no longer get to scream at the traffic in LA traffic when I'm stuck on the freeway. I can no longer curse all the other idiot drivers, you know, who are at a complete standstill five lanes across, because it's an opportunity to catch up on my podcast listening in the car. And I need to be grateful instead of angry. And I resent that.
Oh, God. You have a great way of looking at things. I would never have looked at it. I just came back from LA and I was doing that. And what's better at this age of your life than when you were, when you were 24? What's better at this age than you were, when you were 24 versus now? I mean, a lot of times people 20, 30 years later be like, life isn't as good because of these reasons. But what's good about being this age as opposed to being 24? What's better in your life at this age?
Pressure's off. I mean, I don't have any need to be young anymore. My fragrance is Ooda hand sanitizer. I know that all those aspirational things I used to have stuck up all over the bathroom mirror, I ripped those down, and now I just shut my eyes in the shower. It's much better. It's liberating this age. And also, you know, in 50 things that aren't my fault, part of it is reflection back. Like what happened? What happened to blue jeans? One of my favorite essays was, never ask a woman to just wear jeans. And where I've received an invitation to a party that says, you know, just wear jeans, which for a man, I think you can still pretty much just walk in and grab a pair. For a woman, it's like a multi-mall, multi-search, deep.
Too many choices. It's the same thing with guys. There's slim, there's wide fit, there's boot cut, stretch, well,
there are also the degrees of jeans, you know, the good jeans, the bad jeans, you know, the fancy jeans for the fancy party. Of course, in Los Angeles, people wear what looks to me like pajamas to work. To wear jeans means you're going to something formal, right?
Right, right.
My daughter grew up in Los Angeles. She never saw anybody in a suit or necktie.
Really?
I mean, even at church, you know, it's casual.
Yeah.
Very casual here.
Yeah. In talking about your book and 50 Things That Aren't My Fault, do you feel the Me Too movement didn't come fast enough? Are you surprised that it came at all? I mean, I know in Kathy, in your strip, you talked about the touchdown a little bit when you had a boss that gave you a ride home and invited himself in for a drink. But how I was just someone who I feel is, you know, I'll give you the label of feminist. I don't know if you like that or not. And I mean that with all, a positive attribution. How has that been playing out for you?
You know, with joy and horror, you know, honestly, because it seems like the Me Too movement is so kind of late in being so public. And then it's, you know, it's horrifying and sad that it's not fixed, you know, that we thought we would be way, way, way beyond that now. And we are. I mean, when I was first working in an office, you know, it was it was like in the Mad Men era, you know, where not that I have caught up on those shows yet. All of those to watch. But right. I know that that was back in the, you know, the patting the secretary on the butt days. And that, you know, that's the environment where I went to work. And it's the fact that, well, I love that women are finding their voices, that more women are being heard. I wish more women were being heard with less criticism of them. You know, I just can't believe that women are not being believed when they tell their stories, especially when people say, well, why didn't you say something 20 years ago? And, right. you know, if you were working in that environment 20 years ago, you know why nobody could say anything. It's hard right. enough to say it now when there's some way to say it. So,
well, it's funny, you know, you had something you said that gives context to that. And it's 1976 isn't that long ago. You said, when I started this trip in 76, people were actually arguing about things like, should a woman be allowed to have a job and should girls be allowed to play sports? It's impossible to remember now how divided everyone was about basic rights for women. And if you think about that, you're right. So in a way, sadly, we shouldn't be shocked that it's taken this long for the boogeyman of sexual harassment to come out of the closet. I mean, you're so right about, it was just 1976 is not that long ago. And these conversations were having to be had about what women can do for basic rights. It's insane.
I think it's still very challenging for women in the workplace, you know. I'm proud of all the women who have been able to make an impact.
Right. Absolutely. Well, just sort of in finishing up, you've talked about, you know, writing the strip, which God bless you, you had to do that every day for 365 days a year. Were there any days where you just were like, man, I got nothing? Or how? Because I've written on TV shows. I used to write on The Daily Show. And there'd be some mornings where you go in and you're like, I just don't have it today. Like, how did you get through that? How did you do that?
I think, you know, I did more than 10,000 strips. And I think that there were probably 9,999 days where I went, oh, my God, I got nothing.
But then you pull it out.
Well, the deadline is a powerful thing. So.
Yeah. You talk about the long form writing as taking off Spanx, you know, kind of freeing you up in a way. Did the form affect your point of view? Like, did you find your point of view became more honed, or not that it ever wasn't, but because you had the luxury of writing more than just a strip, did that change how you looked at things? Did that change how you arrived at some points of view at all, or anything like that?
You know, sadly, it didn't change the way I wrote, because the way I write is the same way I shop, where I have to try on every single word before, before I finish the sentence. Yeah. Like, you finish the sentence and then you go back and rewrite it, and then you go back and rewrite it, and then you go back. It's just like, it's exactly like how I shop for anything. Come home with a bag of clothes, try them all on, take them all back. Go come home with another bag, try them all on, take them back. So I wrote the comic strip like that. Of course, I was forced, the words were squashed into a much smaller space.
Right.
But essays were, you know, they were just so wonderfully liberating to get to, honestly, to get to write more thoughtfully and more completely about subjects that I really care about, you know, relationships between mothers and daughters and relationships between ourselves and the, you know, the magnifying makeup mirror and relationships even between ourselves and, you know, our love stories, you know, who we, what we thought would happen, how we blew it, you know, all of that. This time of life kind of imposes a certain, it's not imposes, it's like, it opens up an opportunity for reflection. And I love getting to do that. I couldn't have done that in the strip. I love getting to do it. But was it torture to write them? Because I had to review every word 7 billion times. Yes, it was.
Well, what's nice about the book is it's like you're revisiting old friends, readers of your strip, and checking in and saying, kind of, hey, let's reconnect. How are you doing? What's going on in your life? Here's what's going on in my life, and sharing some commonality, maybe.
Well, you know, besides my own need to just kind of dump some of this time of life onto paper, and it truly did come from a real need to do that, to get it out of me and onto paper, which is how I process everything from, you know, a bikini to, you know, to a discussion with my mom, is to put it on paper and try to find the joke. Right. Besides that, there was, I felt a huge, again, the word guilt, but guilt about abandoning readers who had really come to rely on Kathy as kind of a touchstone of something, you know, who was a friend. And I just, when I quit the strip, I just like quit. And I felt like I left, I kind of left a lot of women wondering why. And kind of left them without that touchstone in the day. And I know that at least a lot of women and their mothers who were fans of the comic strip during our dating and dieting and dreaming years, I know that they're going through a lot of the same great big transitions that I am now. And I wanted to, I really wanted to pick up with them now and to kind of reassure them that here we all are again, you know, here's where we are after all those years, and reconnect with them. And my goal, you know, has never been to save the world. It's just been to help somebody else get through the next 5 minutes. And I'm hoping that 50 Things That Aren't My Fault will do that.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. I mean, it's, and your wit is continues to be razor sharp. And I do think it's, for me, it's gender neutral. I mean, you know, I think that the, I often say the jokes that I tell on my act are just, the words are just vehicles to convey a certain point of view or an emotion that is a shared experience for people. You know, I feel like if I'm experiencing it, 95% of the people in the room are too. And I think you do that so effectively with your writing. So,
Thank you. And you do too. I mean, I've watched your, that's exactly what you do when you talk about everything.
Yeah, I try.
It comes from the truth, you know.
I try. There's something in me that feels like, you know, I have to confront people when I think they're wrong, even though my wife is like, you don't always have to say something. And so I started to just, instead of writing, I think when you start out doing stand-up, you just write what you think everybody is going to laugh at, and then you break through to a place where it's almost like it's cathartic, and I need to write this, otherwise my head's going to explode, and I need to express these things. Like, you know, we had a dog that we had to put down, and then I refused. We took our dog home because I refused. They were going to charge us too much. So I got in an argument with the vet tech and said, we're going to find a cheaper place to have our dog killed. And I took the dog home and we went to a different place. And my son woke up and said goodbye to the dog. And he goes, why is the dog here? Is the dog okay? And my wife's like, no, your father's a raving lunatic. That's what the problem is. And then we took him to the ASPCA, and they wanted $500 to put the dog down at this private vet place in New York City. It was open 24 hours, and there was nobody else in the place, and the ASPCA wanted $85. I was right, but I was probably not of right mind when I did so. I really relate to you. You wear it on your sleeve, and I think that's a good thing. I think that's a really good thing.
Well, I really appreciate your humor as well.
Absolutely. Well, 50 Things That Aren't My Fault, Kathy Geiswhite, really great to have you on. Check the expiration dates on your parents' food. I don't want to hear you got sick or ended up in the hospital, and I will do the same. And it was really wonderful to have you on. I've been a really big fan of yours for a long time.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate being here. Appreciate it.